one is the volume that we are using. I suggest that you purchase volume one of the art scroll Kiddushin. Volume one of Kiddushin is involved. It is available in two forms, the small form, which is the one that I have, or a larger form, which is actually easier to read, but a little bit more difficult to carry around. So that is the text that we're using. Number two, I gave a rather extensive introduction on concepts and language, some of which, if you've been in the Talmud class before, it's not unusual, stuff that I've said before. Most of which, however, is not stuff that I said before, because it was relating to the language in the Bible that describes marriage. And I was trying to demonstrate to you that the Bible really uses two words from the book of Genesis on to describe the state of marriage, and the words are forms of the word lakach, he took, and the second part of that was lahavi, to bring, to cause the person to come into another sphere, okay? And what I did at the latter part of the session last week was to describe the way in which, in fact, until the Middle Ages, Jewish marriage consisted of two completely different ceremonies. One ceremony in year one, which was called the Erusin or the Kiddushin. And what we are reading about here is that ceremony. It is those issues that are relevant to the Kiddushin. And that is the parallel to Lakach. To Lakach. That he took for himself a wife. What we would say in English, take, has a very multiple meaning existence in the Hebrew language. And when we will get to, let's say, the monetary stipulations of the wedding ceremony, I think one errs if one sees this in monetary terms. What you have to see is that this is the long-term progression of lakach. Again, lakach in Hebrew is a monetary term, but in the Bible it's not used that way in relation to marriage. So that is the first part, lakach, that is the erusin ceremony. The second part of the ceremony was the chuppah. And the ketubah, for example, was relevant not to the first part, but to the second part of the ceremony. The chuppah was coming into the sphere of the husband. Right? And that was symbolized by the chuppah. And that was in the story of the creation in Genesis 2, was not that God took, again the word was took, lakach, he took one of the bones of Adam, and then God brought Eve to Adam, right? There is the bringing, and it is the bringing that is the second part of the ceremony, okay? Now all of this is on the internet. The entire lecture from last week can be heard on the internet. It is available there. Jay puts it up quickly after the class. I mean, maybe not minutes after the class, but a day after the class. What? A few seconds? When you get home. Oh, that is minutes after the class. Yes.
In the English translation, I mean, you say token is a friend, but very often I recall the expression was they knew each other. Mm-hmm.
That's different. That's yada, which in fact refers, that is a euphemism for sexual relations. Neither of the terms that I have used so far is that term. And neither of them really means sexual relations, although it may be implied. Okay, any other questions? Yes.
I am commented this a little bit, he did not mention the other version of the creation of Adam and Eve in chapter 1,
mm-hmm.
which is that from the land of the lovers, Zachar and Kibaba also. So, does it matter?
Well, you will see later on, we will come upon this, it actually matters a great deal, because one of the ways in which the Talmud, following the Midrash, deals with that, there are two stories of creation, chapter 1 and chapter 2 of Genesis. And chapter 5 also recapitulates, to some extent, chapter 1, although it says it slightly differently. And in about the second verse of the fifth chapter, if I'm not mistaken. And that is quite important. Read this at the beginning of the fifth chapter. Eilat Toldot Adam, you in the fifth chapter?
Chapter
5. Chapter 5. Verse chapter
Toldot Adam, ביום ברוא אלוהים אדם בדמות אלוהים עשה אותו זכר ונקבה בראם.
אוקיי, זכר ונקבה בראם. אוקיי, so that is a sort of a recapitulation of a language slightly different from Genesis 1.
That sentence is interesting. They write Shmam in plural. Shmam Adam Biyom Baram.
Correct. Biyom Baram. So there, so what the Midrash does is to say that there was an initial creation which was one being that was male and female. There was a female-male-female combination that was, that's called the androgyne, that's in Plato's Symposium. The classic expression of that is in Plato. And the rabbis have a similar story in the Talmud, and so it's of significance because what they do with the two chapters is to say chapter 1 is a single creation, and what we read about in chapter 2 is the splitting of the two into two separate creations. Okay. So it's a kind of a lovely idea, it's almost a romantic idea, and you'll see it coming back again and again. This idea pops up in the Talmud. You'll see that. Anything else? Yes?
The creation of the female from Sela, from what we translate as a bone, the Rambam, I think, says Sela is a side, like if you have a cube.
So that's the Talmud.
That's
what the Talmud says. Right. The word Sela, which means rib, it's usually translated as rib into English. Sela, as the Talmud says, is Sela HaMishkan. Okay, in the book of Exodus, you have that phrase, Sela HaMishkan. That means the side of the tabernacle. The side of the tabernacle. It's the same Hebrew word, Sela. So they say then in the Midrash, Sela also means side, because that is Genesis 1, which is the original creature had two sides, and he took one Sela, one side, and made it into the female by separating the two. Okay? So that's, you have that, and you'll see it's going to pop up from time to time. It's much better than that? Maybe yes, maybe no. It's very interesting. Remember what we said, we saw a source, by the way, where is my, somewhere my notes. We saw the source, Jacob and Rachel, Genesis 29:14, of the language, Atzmi ubisari, Atzmi ubisari, my bone and my flesh. That was in the language of Laban. And remember the original creation of Eve. God brings Eve to Adam after Adam has seen the animals and is looking for a mate in the animals. That doesn't work. He brings Eve and he says, Etzem ne atzamai basar mi bisari, bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. Right? So that is also a nice idea. But this is a slightly different idea. Okay.
Selim is also shadow.
That's Selim. It's different. That Selim is that is we translate as image. Okay. This is Selah in Ayin. Sadi Lamed Ayin. Sadi Lamed Ayin. Okay. Okay. Now, yes.
One question.
Is it implied in this midrash or in the general discussion of energized, separating, and then brought back together? Does it imply that this is the nature of marriage itself?
Correct. You know, what it implies is that, according to this midrash, marriage is the search for the lost self. And it is the coming together of an original self that was a sort of a divine self or a divine creation of self that is what one looks for and what one has hopefully found.
I think that's all of this physical manifestation. Talking about, very interesting, but I think it misses the mark of what's trying to be said here. I think the conversation that seems to me is trying to be communicated, that the marriage and the creation is people of one flesh, two people on the same way.
Many ways you could understand that. I won't say one way or the other. I think that once you have a metaphor such as the embryonic metaphor for, it can be understood in a wide variety of ways. Let's go back to the text. I want to now go immediately to the Mishnah chapter 1. We quickly read through the Mishnah last time, and then I begin to go back a little bit. Now I want to deal with the Mishnah slowly, and we'll go into the Gemara. The Mishnah, remember the Mishnah is the earlier stratum of the Talmud. The Mishnah is edited in the year 200 CE by Rabbi Judah the Prince. And the Talmud itself is a combination of Mishnah and Gemara. The Gemara is to some extent commentary on the Mishnah, but that commentary may actually be an edited form of something that was a discussion that was in the same time as the Mishnah. Same period, in year 0 to 200 roughly. So here we have the Mishnah, Ha'isha niknet b'shalosh derachim. The woman may be, now there's no other way to translate this, but acquired probably in English. I'm uncomfortable with all of these terms because, again, involved in the Hebrew is are the many, many shades of the meaning here. So keep that in mind, that is the force of niknet, and you will see it when we get into the Gemara. Woman is acquired by shalosh drachim in three ways. Hikone et atzma, and she acquires herself by shtei drachim in two ways. Niknet becheses bishtar ubedia. She is acquired through money, through a document, or through sexual relations. The chesed, when we say money, Beit Shammai omrim de dinar, u'bishava dinar. Beit Shammai says we are talking about the quantity of money called a dinar, which is a large quantity of money, u'bishava dinar. Not only money, but some object worth that amount of money. Now, that's a distinction that's actually quite important in the law, because it's a question for a wedding ceremony. If we say that key to the wedding ceremony is kesef, money, well, maybe that means money. And you have to have money in the ceremony. Or is it shaveh kesef? Is it something that is an equivalent, something that has a value, that is a monetary value, but is not money per se? Hold on. We'll get to it. Okay, Beit Shammai omrim bedinar, ubeshava dinar. Beit Shammai says a dinar or something worth a dinar. Ubeit Hillel omrim, and the school of Hillel says, bifruta ubeshava pruta. We are referring here to a pruta, which is a very small coin, ubeshava pruta, or something worth a pruta. Vechama hi pruta, how much is a pruta? Echad mishmonim b'isara italki, one-eighth of an Italian isar. Vekone et atzma beget uvemitat abal. She acquires herself with a get or through the death of the husband. Hayivama niknet b'zi'a vekone et atzma bechalitza uvemitat ayavaham. The Yevama, a Yevama, and I'll explain this in a moment, is acquired through sexual relations, and she acquires herself through Chalitza and through the death of the Yavam. Okay? Let's go to the Rashi. Remember, I said to you that the Talmud itself is nearly impossible to understand. I'm sure for those of you who have heard this sound for the first time, you understand it perfectly. Those of you who hear it now for the second time, of course you understand it perfectly. The pair is also to read the Rashi. Rashi is crucial. And the English commentary that we have here in the Schottenstein Talmud is based on Rashi. It's a very good commentary based on Rashi. But it's much more to learn how to read the Rashi. Now, the Rashi is always in the Hebrew text. The Talmud is in the middle of the page. Okay, here's the Talmud in the middle of the page, right over here. On the side of the binding is where Rashi is. Rashi is always on the side of the binding, on the opposite side of the Tosafot. That's on the outside, not on the binding side, Tosafot. Rashi dates from 1040 to 1105. Frenchmen from 1040 to 1105. The Tosafot are one and two generations of Frenchmen after him. Okay? So that's the period of time that Tosafot is the 12th century, Rashi is the 11th century. Now, Rashi is the key one to read. Ha'isha niknet lebala. The woman is acquired lebala by her husband. Vishalosh drachim. In three ways. Ki ben nefaresh ba'aziel. As is explained right ahead of us. Ha'hai shalosh l'shon nekevahu. He points out what is going to become an issue in the Talmud, that the word shalosh is a feminine word. It's a feminine word. You know, those of you who know Hebrew, you have shalosh or shlosha. Shlosha is masculine, shalosh is feminine. Now, the word derachim, if you are looking at derachim, is it masculine or feminine just in terms of the standard ending? It's got a yud mem ending. Im, yeladim. Now it has a masculine ending. Okay? Well, that's what you think. That's what you think. Because you're Israeli. That doesn't mean you know Hebrew. You're going to read the Talmud. Sometimes it's masculine, sometimes it's feminine. That's one of the things the Talmud is going to go into. But Rashi is tipping us off to begin with that shalosh is lashon nekeva, is feminine form of the adjective. Okay? And Rashi will often do that. Ubi gamara ba'e amai tana lashon nekeva. And the Gemara will ask the question, why does the Mishnah use the feminine form of the adjective when it would seem from the derachim that derachim appears to be a masculine noun? Okay, that's what Rashi is. He's not explaining it yet because the Gemara will explain it. He's simply tipping us off. It's a, what do we say in modern English? Heads up. It's a heads up. Okay, this is Rashi's heads up for an unusual thing that the Gemara is going to eventually talk to us about. And she acquires herself in two ways. Garcina, this is a particular form he has in his text. Here the force of that is that she is now birshuta, she has her own authority. She is now her own authority in order to be married to someone else. And keep in mind what's implied here. What is implied is what is in fact very central to the notion of marriage, abstractly and very much in this text, which is the exclusivity of what is being arranged here. There is an exclusivity, certainly, absolutely, absolute exclusivity as far as the woman is concerned, somewhat less so for the man, because realize that this is written in a polygamous society. In a polygamous society, the very essence of that society is that a man has the option of having more than one wife. So it's not exactly the same. But what is happening here is that part of what is going on is something that sets into motion a new reality which has a variety of things that characterize it, primarily exclusivity. And you'll see the way that is developed in the Torah. All right, let's go on. The Chesef Ubishtar. The Chesef Ubishtar. And with Kesef and with a document. Nifaresh Bivraita Bigmara. It is explained in a Baraita. Now that's a key term if you're not used to the term. Baraita. A Baraita is something, a piece of Talmud that dates from the time of the Mishnah but is not in the Mishnah. Baraita means outside us. When Rabbi Judah the Prince edited the Mishnah in the year 200 CE, he left out a lot of material. That material is later brought in the Gemara, and it's called a Baraita. It's outside of the Mishnah, but it is contemporaneous with the Mishnah. Okay? So this is brought in the Baraita, in the Gemara. Notein la kesef o shabe kesef. He gives her money or something that is the equivalent of money, v'omer la, and he says to her, Hare at mekudeshet li. Now that is the way in which the money has to be given, and this is going to be crucial, because money, and we'll see the significance of money, money is frequently passes from the hands of one person to another. Does money that passes from the hands of one person to another constitute marriage? Obviously it couldn't. It couldn't. Even if we say that money is crucial to something that happens has to consist of more than money. And what that consists of is that he says to her, Hare at nikudeshet li. With this, you are nikudeshet li. Now that's a tough term to translate. Usually translated as betrothed to me. In no way does it mean that. It has absolutely nothing to do with any English concept of betrothal. It is, in the context of what we are talking about here, an erusin. It is a moment where something happens that will lead to a new reality. A change of reality is going to take place after that happens. Part and parcel of that change is that there is a transaction that takes place, and it must be accompanied by a verbal statement. Now just think about that in general terms in the laws of purchases. If we're going to think in terms of purchase, because that's an analogy to this, but we're going to see that that's only one possible analogy. When you go into a store, what constitutes a purchase? What constitutes a purchase?
The exchange of money.
The exchange of money, I think, constitutes the purchase. I'm just going to raise some other possibilities for you. What if you say you're going to pay money and you don't pay money? Have you bought it? Well, is it a different issue?
No.
What if it burns down? Who's lost it? Who's lost it?
In some contracts, transfer of title could be to the old owner until you pay.
Mm-hmm.
Because let's say you moved it out of the country, mm-hmm. and you didn't pay, they want to reclaim it.
Okay.
In other places, if it's lost, it's a different story.
So you're saying to me, it all depends. In other words, it's not so simple. Okay, that's my point. It's not so simple. We think that it's simple. Once you pay your money, you get your goods. You know? There are a variety of ways that one can take possession, as it were, of objects. And sometimes those ways differ between different types of property. real property transactions are not necessarily the same as movable property transactions. So those of you who are in those fields know that, you know, to get a bill of lading or you have to sign for something, you want to know if, God forbid, it would be destroyed or stolen, whose is it? Because you would much prefer, if something bad happens to it, to be the other guy's and not yours. But the other guy wants to be sure it's yours. So obviously you need laws that will in fact somehow convey clearly to all the parties concerned that there has been a change of status in something. The simplest things that we usually deal with are the changes of status of ownership, because that's when you want to know whether the object is yours or it's still Walmart's. Okay? That's a crucial thing. Right? Something happens. And that something that happens is between one party and another party. There is a need to have some level of general understanding that this is recognized as something that happens. It might even be witnessed. Certain types of transactions, I'm sure you have in some of your businesses, certain types of transactions you have to have a signature notarized. Or you may actually need witnesses to certain documents. Okay? Now, it depends on what the things are, what the transactions are. But the essence of what is going on here is that we're involved in a change of status. It's actually the exact same thing afterwards as it was before. Right? When you buy something, most cases, it's exactly the same after as it is before. It's the same object. You're the same, it's the same. But your relationship has changed. You have a relationship to it that you didn't have before you purchased it. Okay, so purchasing is a way with objects that we change their status, and we have to decide in purchasing how we know when the purchase has been made.
Question, who gets the money? Who is the money given to?
Mm-hmm.
And also, is it possible to be a one-sided process? The guy stands there and says, use the money, or ask Mr. Bishop, and he says, no, I don't want to.
Mm-hmm. All these are good questions, and the Talmud's going to discuss all of those questions.
Yeah.
Of course it has to, because there's an even more obvious question. Does the money have to be worth anything? Realize that in the argument between Shammai and Hillel here, that's what's going on. Shammai is saying, when you make, what is kesef? Nichnet the kesef. What is kebet Shammai omring? Did dinar. A dinar is equal to 192 prutot. Beit Hillel says a pruta. Well, there's a big difference between 192 prutas and one pruta. What's the force of that? The force of that is that Shammai is saying, when you make a deal, it's got to be real money involved. And what Hillel is saying is, no, this is not a deal with money. The money is not the issue here. This is what we would call a peppercorn transaction. This is a peppercorn transaction because the nature of what is happening here is entirely symbolic. And if it is symbolic, then the issues that you raise will have to be raised. Namely, can you just do it in secret, for example? Can things which are essentially symbolic in nature be done in private? In fact, as you will see, this cannot be done in private. It must not be done in private. It's not recognized that it's done in private. It must be duly witnessed. It has to be witnessed. Okay? But I'm just trying to feel my way into this naturally and see why it has to be witnessed. Huh?
I guess the reason I'm confused about the money is that Gail and I were married, someone made a mistake in the children had the wrong amount of money. We had to do the hotel all over and everything.
Now remember, we're not talking about the ketubah here. Keep in mind, can I help you? I hope you worked it all out. I know you had a good rabbi who is... you wanted the rabbi. The rabbi, a friend of mine, I know that he was a very competent guy. So I'm sure that he saw to everything that it was done right. Here, keep in mind that so far we have not addressed the ketubah at all. In fact, we're going to get to it. I'm only saying my words about kesef. I've only addressed one thing, the word kesef, and what the force is of kesef in whatever is going on here. I'm trying to stress that what you are witnessing is a change of status. No, nothing is different. The people are exactly the same people afterwards, but there's a different relationship. And that is symbolized, and emphasizing the symbolic nature of the transaction, the peppercorn transaction that is advocated by Hillel. And we haven't gotten the shtar, but I'll give you a tip off, a heads up on this. The shtar is not the ketubah. This written document is not a ketubah. This is not the ketubah. Ketubah is something else.
It's not obvious to me that you're trying to test it. It's so ambiguous.
No, it is. Well, you know why? Because what is translated into English? What does it mean? Oh, does it mean silver, or does it mean what's the alternative? Give me another translation. Money. Yeah. Which is it? Oh, that's correct. It may very well be that Shammai is much more, he's really onto something. You know, we shouldn't dismiss Shammai so quickly. It happens to be that it is dismissed. That the law doesn't go according to Shammai. But it may be that Shammai's reaction here is the most logical of the reactions, and that Hillel's reaction is really a radical reaction. It is saying, basically, I don't want this thing to look like a real transaction.
Well, it may be a jealous thing.
Well, whatever it is, whatever it is.
I'd be emphasizing something else other than money in what's happening.
That's exactly right. He may be very aware of the fact that money is money, and when you see money, you see transactions, and you think about buying and all that stuff, and he doesn't like that.
Why?
It doesn't say a dinar.
Yeah,
it's all culture. He can't, you know why? Because the Torah says, ki yikach ish isha, when a man takes a wife. And that doesn't mean just take. We're going to get to that in the Gemara. In fact, what we are involved in is not a taking, but lakachat means some action that indicates publicly a change of status. Okay, that's what we're really talking about here. So then you have it.
I think
you've answered. Okay. All right. I'll be ready for the next one. Yes, sir.
Is this imply ownership?
No.
Yes.
Nope. Because you would want to know. Correct. And that's, I think, one of the things that probably Shammai is sensitive to. Okay? Because you might say that since you're using the language of purchases, that it would imply ownership. Okay? That's certainly a possibility, and it could be understood from the language. We'll have to say in the Gemara whether it does, but I think one of the things to be sensitive to here is that part of what is going on is to fight against that. Okay?
Let me ask you that. After this transaction has a symbolic or otherwise, if I understood that the things remain the same, except that in a marriage it seems to be different than the usual transaction, first is that the things don't remain the same, mm-hmm. that it's a man and a woman become a husband and wife.
Correct. And in this particular transaction, keep in mind what happens here is that they're both the same and different in the following way. In the erusin, remember we are talking about the first part of the marriage ceremony, which only in the Middle Ages is put together with the second part. Our wedding ceremony is two parts at one time. The ketubah is read in the middle to separate between what used to be separated by a year of time. Okay? We are reading about year one here. Once this transaction takes place, what happens is she goes back to her family, he goes back to his family, and they do not live together as husband and wife. Okay? So, in a way, they don't really live together as husband and wife, so that somehow it hasn't happened. Yet, it has happened in certain other ways because the requirements of exclusivity, in fact, have fallen at that very moment when this transaction takes place. So that they are married and they're not married. It's an odd state of affairs. Why it is that way, why it was that way in the ancient world, a little hard to know. It could be because that they had the purpose of, in a pre-modern world, of something of a betrothal, of an engagement. Maybe that was a sociological, that's a way to look at it sociologically. I don't really know. Or maybe it was the long-term playing out of the different terminologies that we also have in the Bible, of lakach and lahavi, of taking and bringing. That in fact these are conceptually two different things that are going on. And I don't know the answer, but I just ask us to be sensitive to it. Sure?
I know I have a sense of that.
It's
based on an entire word, but it certainly had a sense that at that time, the struggle took place when the kids were religious kids, they were quite young, which would certainly provide a reason why they weren't immediately. Mm-hmm. It would have been at least the space of a year. But I mean, it's that, we know that from documentary evidence, that something happened when they were
young. We know that a lot of things happened. Sometimes there were child marriages, and we have plenty of documentary evidence about that in the Talmud and the Bible. But together with that, we have all the evidence in the Talmud of the age of marriage, which was sometime normally between 18 and 24. 18 and 24 was the standard age of marriage. And the Talmud makes it clear what the expected ages of marriage are. So both are happening, and since both are happening, it looks a little bit more complicated. Okay? Yes. Yes, if they change their mind, let's say, that's a good question. Let's say they change their mind. They go through the erusin, what we're reading about here now. They go through that, and they decide, they change their mind. That's a get. And that's the second half of what we're reading. It's Aisha kona et atzma. She acquires herself. There are two ways that she can acquire herself. Namely, there are two ways she can get out of this. One is with a get, and one is by mitat habaal, the death of the husband. Right? There are only two ways to get out of this. It's the get or the death of the husband. Even at this early stage of the game. Okay?
But if they're not formally married yet.
They are.
Oh.
But they aren't.
My gosh.
They are. You're using our terminology.
Right.
And what I am trying to do is to say that our language doesn't fit their situation. Keep it in mind here when you read the English translation. Kiddushin is translated into the English as betrothal. In no way does it mean anything like betrothal in terms of our term, what we mean by it, except for the fact that there's no other term that is in any way equivalent. It's about as close as you can get in English. But it really is a technical term. You have to realize the ramifications of the technical language. Let's go on. Wait, I want to keep going further. Wait, hold on. Okay, so we see that there are two different points of view, Hillel and Shammai. One is a point of view that expects the kesef to be worth something significant, and the other one is not. I'm back in the Rashi. The kesef ubishtar. So we read the first half of this, the meaning of kesef. The omer line, he has to say with her, I'm back in the Rashi. This is now 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 lines down in the Rashi, 6 lines down in the Rashi. Hare at mekudeshet li. Any of you who have been married in recent times, so just can remember what happened. The man takes the ring. He doesn't just place it on her finger. First of all, it has to be on her right forefinger. Right? And he has to, while placing it there, say, Hare at mekudeshet li. With this ring, you are mekudeshet. Literally, sanctified. But you'll see that that's also not a good term. It's not a useful term. It sounds nice, but it sounds nice in English. It sounds very religious. So we tend to use that. actually different. So, Aleah Mekudeshetli. So when you're doing it, you have to make it clear that what you are doing is for the sake of establishing kiddushin or erusin on the basis of kesef, on the basis of something of value, of monetary value. All right? Next one is shtar. Now, shtar, you're tempted to understand that as the ketubah. Not that. Shtar kotev la'al haniyar. He writes her on a piece of paper. Afal pisha eno shabet pruta. Even though the paper isn't worth a pruta. Because you might have said, well, since Beit Hillel said that there had to be a transaction worth a pruta, maybe the key issue in the document is that the document be worth a pruta. And we are simply trying to expand on the notion of kesef by saying that even a shtar, even a document, has some value to it. That's not the point that is being made. The point being made is that there is another means which has nothing to do with the value of the document, because the document can be worth nothing. It is only what is written on the document that is important. And which is, what is written there is, Hare at mikudeshet li. You are mikudeshet li. You are sanctified to me. That is the way number two. Now, the way number three, in light of everything that I've said so far, is a real problem. The third way is bia. That is sexual intercourse between these two people. Now, I already said to you that when this happens, he goes to her, his house, she goes to her house. The whole point of that is that that won't happen. Okay? And here you have this as the third way that you can do this. So let's go on. All right? Bevia zo kul hu yalif nikrai tamad debet shama mefarish bigmara. Oh, all of this it says now. Sorry, go back again. Bia ba'aleh, he has sexual relations with her. Ziamar hitabchi li bevia zo, be sanctified to me with this sex. In other words, sex doesn't do it. Sex doesn't do it. What you have to do is you have to say, with this relation that we are about to have, you are sanctified to me as my wife. Okay? Now. That's correct. What about witnesses? Correct? Now, I'll get to that in just a minute. That, of course, is going to come up. It may be here in the Rashi. Let's see whether it's in the Rashi. Yes, it will be in the Rashi in just a moment, I think. We'll get to that in a moment. So I won't answer that, but we'll read it in the Rashi. But keep in mind what's going on here, because this one is really quite unusual in light of the other considerations that we have here. And, of course, it has a purpose. What you are beginning to deal with the mention of bi'ah, is another type of marriage, which of course has to be dealt with in the laws of marriage, which is what we would call in English the common law marriage. What about a case where there is no wedding ceremony? Namely, man and a woman are living together as husband and wife, and they have the intention of living together as husband and wife. Does the law recognize that? From what you have read so far, you might have assumed no. But the force of this third method is in fact to expand the possibility, because the law has got to take account of that possibility, because of course it's going to exist. What we are doing by structuring a ceremony, it's just that, we're creating a ceremony. And in a way, we're excluding everybody who hasn't gone through that ceremony. But there's no system of law that can really function like that. Because in fact, what if two people decide they're going to live together in husband and wife, and they don't want a ceremony? And you know, they have children. is the state responsible for the children or are the parents responsible for the children? The state will want it very clear that the parents are responsible. The parents might want it very clear that the state is responsible. That somebody has got to clarify, in fact, whether they're married or not. Okay? If there are bills, to what extent are married people responsible for each other's bills? Right? That's all got to be clarified in the legal system. So in fact, what we are doing here is not really opening the door to a third type of ceremony, although you'll see the way in which, in fact, our ceremony is in response partly to these three methods. But what you are doing is opening another avenue to another reality because of the common law marriage. Okay? I don't know. To tell you the truth, this is the only context that I ever saw this in, because it's not allowed. You can't do this. Against the law. But it's there. I don't have the answer for it. Okay?
Is this prohibition? Does
it
have to be voluntary?
Excuse me? What?
Prohibition? Does it have to be...
Oh, that's very important. A very important point. What does the cohabitation have to be voluntary? I'll even ask that more than that. Does any of us have to be voluntary? Right? We have three methods here. Is it voluntary? Or, and it seems that the way this is structured, the man does this. Does she have to agree to it?
Is her parents say so?
Why is the involvement of the parents? This is stuff that you're about 10 minutes ahead of me, but let's pick it up now. Right? Realize that all of those are questions that we have to think about. And interestingly enough, at least so far, we don't see anything about parents. Parents are not involved in this stage of the game. And it's a real question, which we have not yet answered, whether this has to be voluntary, or whether it's a lopsided type of relationship and one can make the decision and force the other one into it. Not at all clear yet. Well, you would think. Why doesn't it say that? Now, one of the things that you should be sensitive to is that it doesn't say that. It doesn't say that. I'll show you in a little bit how important that question is.
It is also a way of saying that you shouldn't be having sex if you're not married.
Definitely. It's certainly assuming that. Okay.
If there is a case of yeah, how does a desire to get a divorce or get work?
Doesn't make any difference. It's something you get if you want a divorce.
But this is not a form of marriage.
It is recognized by the law as a marriage.
So you need a regular get.
A regular get. A regular get.
Okay. I just wanted to point out, and I learned this at about 6:30 this evening, New York State does not have common law marriage. You must be married by an official in order to be married in New York State. And the state legislature, in fact, abolished common law marriages in New York State in the 30s. And I don't know why, but it's a minority among states. There are only about 10 or 12 other states that do not recognize New York common law marriages, and New York is one of them.
Why am I in trouble?
How do you like this? Now you figure it out. Here we go. All this stuff is coming out, and now we're going to see what's now in this stuff. Okay, go ahead. Exactly.
And so the fact that there are three, to a certain extent, makes them equivalent because they're all ways of actually entering into that state, making the transition. But you still haven't dealt with the fact that if you don't want to, by making them each get you there, but if you feel from a public policy standpoint that you don't want them to be considered equal,
exactly. And that's exactly what the rabbis do after the time of the Mishnah. because they don't want this dinner if they're going forever like this. And what they do is create our wedding ceremony, which in fact has all three happen in the following way. In fact, what we do is we have a monetary piece of the ceremony that's still the same. We say, Hare Ata Kodeshet Li B'Taba Azok Kedat Moshe B'Yisrael. With this ring, I be wed according to the law of Moses in Israel. You have to put it on the right forefinger because there have to be two witnesses. The bride then takes it, shows it to the witnesses. It has to be witnessed. So that transaction is taking place. To some extent, we have a star, we have at least a symbolic document in the ketubah, although it's not exactly the same. And then the most novel of these is the sexual one. And what has to happen after a Jewish wedding ceremony is that the bride and the groom go into a room together. Witnesses stand outside the door, and there's no expectation that there will be relations at that time, but it is symbolic that they are in their own space with only each other, and that is then the third necessary part of the Jewish wedding ceremony in response, in the long response, to what we have here as the third method of making Kiddushin. Okay? So that is, in a nutshell, that's what a Jewish wedding ceremony is. It involves each of those three parts. Okay? And they all have to be witnessed. Everything has to be witnessed. Your ketubah has to have two witnesses on it. Your kiddushin, the transfer of something of value, which we use a ring. We use a ring for that. But it doesn't have to be a ring. That has to be witnessed. Has to be two witnesses. The yichud, where the bride and groom are together, that has to be witnessed. Right? So that there's a consistent notion here that all actions that in fact change status, even though they are in fact modified, because the rabbis don't like the third one in particular, so they modify it, but still they try and be consistent by having all of these things duly witnessed in the same fashion. And that's the nature of our ceremony.
Is it two rings or one ring that requires?
One ring. That's why.
You're not required to wear a ring.
Nobody's required to wear a ring. And that's. So keep that in mind. There's no requirement for a ring. There's no requirement at all for a ring in a Jewish wedding ceremony. The whole idea that you have a ring, the ring means this or that, or it's round, nothing to do with it. The only thing that's relevant is that something of minimal value is passed from the hands of the groom to the hand of the bride. And that has been witnessed by two witnesses. That's all that matters. Okay? Let's go back to the Rashi. Rashi says here, I'm back in the Rashi, it's about halfway down, and it's about an inch down into the Rashi. Didiyah, with intercourse. With intercourse, she becomes his wife in every matter. That is to say, it doesn't only have to be a legal transaction. This action is an action that is symbolic of a relationship between husband and wife. And of course, he has to say, you know, be my wife, be consecrated to me as my wife as a result of that. L'chol davar she'im ba legarsham acharkach. If he wants to divorce her afterwards, I'm just trying to think where the Rashi is. This is forget what I just said, because this now we're referring to the latter part of the Mishnah. Let's go back to the Mishnah, so I can explain this in more detail. So we have Beit Shammai, Beit Hillel. What is the pruta? A pruta is, we learn what it is, a very small amount according to Hillel. The kona et atzma beget. Right? She can get out of the marriage with a get. Of course, same thing for him. But here it's put in terms of her. and with his death. Those are the only two ways to break up a marriage. His death and with a get. With a get. Now, keep in mind here, there's another way to do it, and other systems which don't have two ways. Called in, those of you who remember the movie Divorce Italian Style. Do you ever see that movie, Marcello Mastroianni? It's a wonderful movie. It's a wonderful movie, Divorce Italian Style. Gotta go to the movies. Come on, what are you doing with your life? You have to see Marcello Mastroianni. You know his movies?
No, I love them.
They're all the same. They're all the same. They can all be reduced to about two ideas. One is this beautiful, this really handsome guy. You know, all the women are dying for him. And he,
right.
More than that, he's dying for all the women. And that's one side. The other side is, it never works. It never works. So this is the basis of a Marcello Mastroianni movie. So it's a Divorce Italian Style. What goes on there is that he's married to this woman. She's crazy about him. He can't stand her. He can't stand her. And so there's only one way in Italian law you can divorce your wife. Because it goes according to the church. It's mitat. It's only death. So since he can't wait around for her to die, he's got to kill her. He's got to shoot her. So the whole the drama of the movie is every time he gets ready to shoot her, something happens and it doesn't work. Right? And it's hilarious. I mean, it's very, very funny. Very funny. It sounds macabre, but it's not. It's very funny because they're going to have it's Italian humor. They're sure going to have Italian humor.
What happens at the end?
Oh, I'm not going to tell you. I never tell you the end of the movie.
But
keep in mind now that in a Jewish marriage, there are two ways to end the marriage. Okay. Don't take this for granted. You can actually get a divorce. A divorce is a perfectly bona fide way to end a marriage. But it's not the only possibility. We take it for granted. You should not take that for granted. Okay?
Annulment.
That's interesting. An annulment doesn't end the marriage.
It
says it never happened. Correct.
Great.
Okay.
Whoever came up with that.
Okay. We've got that too. It's not dealt with here. Okay. Now I want to go further because it's a little bit more complicated what's coming up now. Hayivama. This is the case of a Yivama. A Yivama. Russia says a Yivama nicknamed Liabam. Yivama is a case in the Bible where a man and a woman are married. The man dies without any issue. There are no children. And he has brothers. The brother is required to marry the wife. Okay? Doesn't make any difference. Because this is a polygamous society. In that society, the brother was required to marry the wife. He had to have another wife. In order to produce a child in the name of his brother, the child would then inherit the original husband and not the second husband. Okay? So this, and it was also for very much for her security too, because there was nothing worse in that world than being a wife, a woman without a husband. There's no economic well-being, there's no family, in fact. So, in that world, it had a meaning.
In this case, she had no choice.
Correct. So, this is called the case of the Yavam. Before we get into it too much, and this is not going to be the subject of this class, there's an entire, the largest tractate of the Talmud is on this subject. Yevamot, Masechet Yevamot is a huge tractate of the Talmud. If you're ever interested in the subject, you read the Yevamot. It is the most complicated tractate in the entire Talmud. If you really want to spend the rest of your life reading this, read Yevamot. It is you won't believe what's in Yevamot. And I read Yevamot, I just laughed. The first thing I did is I laughed. And anybody could have such a piece of literature. It's the kind of thing that only mad computer scientists and atomic scientists could have understood. It is so complicated. Again, you can't believe it until you would read it. It's not to be believed, Yevamot. But the situation of the Yevamah starts with this scenario. Now, the reason that the Tractate is so complicated is that, according to Jewish law, a man is not to is not allowed to have sexual relations with his brother's wife. The Torah forbids it while he's alive. Okay? So that the Torah actually has a very clear prohibition on such relations. And he dies. And suddenly there's a radically new circumstance that occurs. So it's totally anomalous. There is no such other case in the entire Torah. Okay? There's something that the Torah prohibits as one of its most prohibited things. Incest is one of the biggest no-nos in the Torah. Suddenly, it becomes permissible. Right? And required, exactly. More than permissible, it becomes required. It's a requirement that this happens. So this is completely unusual to begin with. And then there are so many other circumstances, because let us say that she is, that the brother is married to his sister, the original husband's sister. There are prohibitions against that. What if the brother is married to his mother? That could happen. Right? A woman has a child, he marries another woman. That woman has a mother, marries the original guy's father. They are then related. Can those marriages take place? That's what this whole tractate is about. That's why you could spend the rest of your life trying to figure it out. And beyond that, to make sure of the whole thing, this came in the history of Jewish law to be totally prohibited. We do not allow these relations. So don't think that this is anything that eventually you could do. It's prohibited. It comes eventually prohibited. However, the way in the time of the Talmud, it's not yet, in the time of the Mishnah, it's not yet prohibited. And in fact, what happens is that if this situation occurs, he is called the Yavam. She is called the Yavama. Literally, Yavam is translated as brother-in-law and sister-in-law. That's what it is. Brother-in-law and sister-in-law. But it's very specific, there's a very specific legal meaning here, okay? Excuse me. In order to not have such a marriage, because the Torah requires that marriage, you cannot have such a marriage if you go through a procedure called chalitza. That involves, in fact, the man, but the woman is involved with this. She goes up to him and she takes off his shoe, and says and spits at him. The idea is to embarrass him in public, because he is not taking upon himself the obligation to his brother. Right? So this is a fascinating ritual, which is meant to humiliate the brother who refuses to marry the sister-in-law upon the death of his brother. The way you can undo this is this procedure of chalitza. Okay? Now, that's what is being referred to here. Says, Hayivaman niknet bizi'ah. If we have a situation where the brother has died, childless, then that marriage, in fact, takes place with sexual relations. It is the sexual relation that causes that marriage. Of course, as you can imagine, the rabbis don't like that too much. But that's what the Mishnah says. And in fact, what the Talmud does in Masechet Yevamot is that it creates a procedure which shadows, which is reflective of the very procedure we just read about. In fact, you need to have a written document, or you go through a whole variety of things. The rabbis create that because they don't like this idea that sexual relations would in fact establish the legal reality of marriage. But according to the Torah, that is the case. The rabbis have to come and later legislate something else in addition to the law of the Torah because they don't like the law of the Torah.
What if the wife of the deceased doesn't want to marry?
Too bad. Unless she can convince him otherwise, she has that power. Which, of course, is one of the reasons the thing becomes outlawed. Not a very good system. Okay?
When we were talking last time about the year in between the first and second ceremonies,
correct.
So would you say that today's engagement before marriage is something akin to that? Or is there anything for an engagement?
There is nothing like an engagement in the Mishnah. To some extent, it is what you have just described. I agree with that. Although it's not exactly an engagement, because in fact you need to get out of it. You need a real divorce in order to get out of that relationship. An engagement, I know once in a while we've had this experience where people get engaged and then they call off the wedding. In fact, what it means is you have to cancel the caterer, pay the bill, and return the ring. Or if you unfortunately had an engagement party, you've got to decide, what do we do with this stuff? Okay? That's reality. It's not a legal divorce. You don't need a legal divorce in Jewish law, you need a legal divorce. I think it's qualitatively different from the engagement, but it bears some relationship to it. Yeah.
In this section, we have only the Kiddushin. This action takes immediately after the Kiddushin, it's not only after.
Correct.
There's
no need. Exactly. According to the Mishnah.
There was no reality in there.
Correct. Correct. In this case, it is bi'ah. Only the sexual relation is what establishes the marriage, according to the Mishnah. As I say, that is outlawed. But that's what the Mishnah says.
So let's say somebody
in Italy,
they live separately, he
died,
so his brother is in the
game? Oh, that's, you have to read Masechet Yevamot. That's it. That's another question. If you have the first part of the ceremony and he dies, is she a Yevama or not? But they couldn't have had relations because they're not allowed to have relations. So you know what? Some say yes, some say no. That's what makes the Talmud interesting. Okay, so just an in-between kind of situation. Great, going on. You must keep going. That's the first Mishnah. Now let's read some of the Gemara. Okay, the Gemara says the following: Ha'ishan nikneid. Maishnai hacha, betani hishan nikneid, umaishnai hatem betani haish mekadehesh. Alright? The Gemara's first problem is that this is the first Mishnah in the first chapter. The first Mishnah in the second chapter of Kiddushin is formulated differently. You know, when you're a lawyer or you're a judge, you're concerned about how the law is formulated. It matters how it's written. Because if it's written differently, probably the ones who wrote it had something in intention. Not always, but you at least have to ask the question. So here, the second chapter of Kiddushin, here it says, Aisha Niknet, that's the way our chapter begins, the woman is acquired, and that's the way this one. Maishna Acha, why is it different than in the second chapter where it begins the Tane, where it teaches Ha'isha Nikneid? Why isn't it taught the same way at the beginning of the second chapter? The woman is acquired. Because the same general idea. Umaishna hatam detani ha'ish mekadesh. There, it says instead of the woman is acquired, the man is mekadesh. First of all, it's a different verb. It's not the verb kana, which is acquired. Instead, it's a very beautiful word, but perhaps is sanctified. He sanctifies her. Right? He makes something holy, if that's what it means. but we don't know what it means. So the question that Tolman is asking is, you've got two parallel situations. One situation is Ha'isha Nikneh, the woman is acquired. The next one is Ha'ish Nikadesh. First of all, the verbs are absolutely different. Why aren't they the same? Is there something about these two situations that's different? That's different, first of all. Secondly, suddenly there are two different verbs, and they're importantly different verbs. One is passive, the other is active. If I say Aisha Miknet, the woman is acquired, it's passive. Ha'ish Mikadesh is active. Is there something to be learned from that? So notice the way the law is going to develop itself, simply from an analysis of the language of the way the statute is written. Okay? Okay, I'm going to, no, we've got to keep going. No. Hold it in. Okay. Aisha mitne domaishnai hatam de tane ha'ish mekadesh nishum de ka bai lemitne kesef. Ah, de ka bai lemitne kesef. The reason why our first chapter uses the verb kuf nun he and not the verb kuf dalid shin is because chapter 1 wants to speak about the subject of money. Money is an issue. Money is part of the symbolic transaction that's going to take place here. And therefore, when we are talking about money, the verb kana is an appropriate verb, because kana means purchase or acquire. And therefore, since money is going to be involved, it makes sense to use that verb when discussing money. And here, we wouldn't learn that in any abstract way. We're going to learn it from scriptural sources. There are verses here. Kesef min alam. Where do we learn the Torah that kesef, money, is related to kana, kuf nun he, the Hebrew verb? Where do we learn that in the Torah? Gamar kicha kicha. We learn the two uses of the term kuf chet he, of the verb lakachat. To take, to purchase. Where do we already have taken? In our study last time we said, he takes her for a wife. Uyikachota le'isha. He takes her for a wife. That uses the term take. Right? Kicha, kicha. There's another place that the term take is also used. And that is here. Kicha misdei Ephron. From the Torah reading, not this coming Shabbat, but the following Shabbat, where in fact Abraham is going to buy a parcel of land from Ephron the Hittite, right? And he's going to pay him kesef to take the land. Now, kicha, the verb taking, doesn't mean taking, it means purchasing there. Strangely, it's also used to take a wife, and therefore the way in which the Talmud works is that if you have two verbs that are the same verb used in two different contexts, you can learn about one context from details of the second context. If in the context of Abraham that verb is used in connection to kesef, then, in the context of marriage, where you have the same verb used, even if it doesn't mean purchase, still you can use kesef. Kesef can be part of the symbolic transaction of taking. Right? So therefore, to begin with, we learn marriage, we learn the details of the transaction of marriage from the transaction of Abraham with Ephron the Hittite. And both become transactions that can be consummated on the basis of kesef. Right? Uchtiv hatam, and there in the story of Ephron the Hittite, it says, Natati kesef hasadeh, I have given the money for the field, kach mineni, take it from me, take it from me. Vikicha ikre kinyan, and taking is a form of kinyan, acquisition, is kinyan. Kinyan is from the Hebrew verb kuf nun he, to acquire. And what does our Mishnah say? Isha Niklet, the woman is acquired. So what we have learned now is that we can have a formulation of acquisition, not because this is actually an acquisition, but because, in fact, the Torah uses the term to take, and the meaning of the term to take is used elsewhere in the story of Ephraim the Hittite as a form of acquisition which involves a transfer of something of value, and therefore we know that the change of status that takes place with marriage can be symbolized also by kesef. So you see, this analysis is based on biblical verses. It's based on the common appearance in two different places of the same verb. Okay, we'll go on. Tichti v'sadeh shakana Avraham. Now we're over to the next one, 2A2. Oh, I'm sorry, you're probably already on 2A2. You're now over on 2B. 2B1. Doesn't make any difference. If it comes from the same root, it's the same thing.
So let's talk about where the root comes from.
Mm-hmm.
What preceded both of them?
No idea. I have no idea. All I did last time I showed you that in the second chapter of Genesis, the verb lakach, to take, is used first. The first place it appears in the Torah is that God took a rib from Adam. And what I tried to demonstrate was that if that is the first use of the term, then it's simply the actual creation of the two creations is involved with that verb. That's its first appearance. Okay? Later on, it is used in the context of marriage in terms of he took a wife. But it all comes from the very first appearance, which is the taking of the rib.
Okay. The connection to money comes from
the story of Abraham. The connection with money has nothing to do with anything about marriage. It comes from the use of the same word in relation to the transaction between Abraham and Ephraim the Hittite.
Well, not quite nothing. She was
the
wife.
The purpose of the transaction has a marital
right. Oh, well, that's true. Correct.
Right.
That's correct.
Correct. That's true.
Yes.
Money is the same because they're not actually using the same word. The citing is evidence. Abraham lakach that touched on that.
And the other one's kana. The other one's kana. That's why I go over into 2B. The next thing the Talmud says, the Talmud offers another possibility because it has exactly your question. What? No, not yet. We've got to finish this now. The Talmud says next, Inami Sadot Fakeset Yiknu. Right? Here it wants to have the verb Kana associated with kesef, with money. And it takes a verse now from the book of Jeremiah, where those are put together, and therefore it's smoother with the niknet. I like the other one better though, or you put them all together in the answer. Okay? Tani Ha'isha Niknet, therefore the Mishnah formulates itself as the woman is acquired. I want to go a little bit further. For another 7 minutes. Okay, the Gemara goes on. If that's true, then nitne hatam ha'ish koneh. If it's true what you are telling me, why then, I understand now why chapter 1 says what it says. So why doesn't chapter 2 use the verb kana? All right. Chapter 2, we said, starts with ha'ish mikadesh. It uses kuf dalet shin. Mikadesh, sanctifies. Why doesn't it use, put it, chapter 1 is in the passive because the woman is acquired. So take the same verb and put it in the active, ha'ish koneh, the man acquires. Why use mikadesh? Right? So it's going to play back and forth on these two chapters. And the Talmud answers, Me'ikara tani lishna diaraita. The first use of language in the first chapter is language which is from the Torah. Ulavasof. The latter use of language, tani lishna derabbanan, is rabbinic Hebrew. Fascinating. The idea of kiddushin is a rabbinic idea that doesn't appear in the Torah. Does not appear in the Torah.
Well, how did that develop?
You don't know. So you'll see, they will give you one theory in the next line. But right now, they say that the first chapter uses language of the Torah, the second chapter uses language of the rabbis. Okay? Of course, what you are going to see again and again here is that the law of marriage is a combination of the law of the Torah and the law of the rabbis. So in fact, there's nothing unusual, but they're simply pointing out by the use of language per se that one is the law of the Torah, the language of the Torah, and the other is the language of the rabbis. Now the Gemara goes on and defines that. Umay lishna de rabbanan. What is the force of the rabbinic language? In other words, what does nikandai, what are the what's the sense or the overtone of the use of the verb kushkalad shin as used by the rabbis, since that's not used with marriage in the Torah? Here it says, da'asala akuli alma kehetesh. She becomes prohibited to the entire world like something that is hektesh. Hektesh is a concept in rabbinic Hebrew. It goes out of the Torah. Where if you offer something to the temple, let's say you have whatever you're going to offer to the temple, you're offering the temple a sheep, right? And you say, this sheep I am giving to the temple. At that point, at some point anyway, that sheep becomes the temple. Can you use the sheep yourself once the temple owns it? No way! Because once God owns it now, once God owns it, you can't use it for your own. I mean, you know, unless you figure out a way to ask God to give it back to you. But as long as it's God's, look, it was the next guy's, you couldn't shech the next guy's sheep to the person. You're going to shech God's sheep? You can't do that. Okay? So once you have made a statement that transfers ownership to the sphere of the holy, okay, then you can have no use of that object, whatever it is. It's an absolute difference between us two different spheres. Here, what the Talmud is saying is, da'asavale akuli alma kehekdesh, just as hekdesh, that which has been transferred to the sphere of the holy, cannot be used by anyone other than in that sphere, so the woman becomes prohibited to everybody outside of her husband. That is the force, then, of the use of the verb kufdalad shen. Okay? Lekadesh. Of course, no rabbi will tell you that, because what we like to do, and what rabbis like to do, is to say that the difference between the two Hebrews is that this adds the level of holiness to it. Alright, that's what you're
right.
And which is also true. Because after all, it's comparing it to the Hekdesh,
right,
to that which is involved with God. It's also true.
Yes.
But this is the Gemara then says that the language of the second chapter introduces this additional dimension. Now realize what we are doing, the process here, just the intellectual process that's going on. We are learning from the use of language a variety of concepts that are in one way or another relevant to the subject of what does it mean to pass from a state of not being married to a state of being married. Okay? Number one, how do you get there? We've learned that from language. We've had no discussion of any conceptual ideas that haven't come out of language. It is simply the language of the Torah or the language of the Mishnah. In fact, that chapter 1 begins one way, chapter 2 begins another way. How could that be? From this we learn it could be this, it could be that. And we're in a way building a concept not on the basis of a rational exposition of the concept, but simply from the use of language, the way the words appear in the text. That's very characteristic of the Talmud. The Talmud will not develop an idea the way we would develop an idea. Instead, it begins with a legal analysis, an analysis of the way the law has been framed, and from that we'll slowly develop now concepts that are related to the notion of marriage itself. Question?
Both Kana and Kiddushin deny the aspect of voluntarism by the wife.
Yes, you didn't get to that yet. Come back next week. Come back to the next subject, Matan. Yes.
Have we seen explicitly the contrast between Torah and Rabbanim
before?
Not so explicit,
because
very
this
striking.
Very striking. And you will see that again and again in the laws of marriage, that the laws of marriage are very much a combination. The Rabbis are very aware and self-conscious of what is going on here. That in fact they are doing something that is clearly their thing, and they are maybe justifying their thing on the basis of the Torah. Maybe it's going naturally out of the Torah. We don't know. But they are quite self-conscious about it.
It's extraordinary the articulation, whereas before in our other books, we do inference.
Right.
From the
contrast. Correct. Yes.
You say the initial doubt the husband owned the woman, the wife, you say no.
Right.
But then they bring this to the story of Abraham and they use the word kinyan. Kinyan means ownership.
But it doesn't with marriage. With marriage, the same word means something else. Right? With marriage, what it means is an act that makes it clear that there is a change of status, which is also what kinyan is. Ownership involves that as well. So that there is a level of analogy, but there is a limit to the level of analogy.
Because Abraham would insist that it would be transfer of sanctuary and a professor.
Correct.
That's the reason they use the kinyan.
Correct. And you just try to do that with your wife. And you will know that it's not the same.
No idea.
If we can habitually call the Torah.
That's a good point. Because you're saying that when you're talking about the Kadesh vis-a-vis human beings, it's not the same as it is with animals.
Right.
It's really not. Rashi uses the animal, the Talmud uses the animal analogy, but it's really not a very, it's not a completely apt analogy. Your analogy might be a better analogy, that in a way there is a dedication to the holy, to the realm of the holy, but it's not so absolute. It's not so absolute as in the case of the animal. To be continued. And what is that mean? Separate. What they are.